I was told that the people who were in charge of renting out the room were surprised that we didn't ask for any AV equipment. This is the point where I wish we could have a little slideshow. Late Sunday afternoon, I'm getting hoarse. It'd be nice to have a guided tour through the jhanas up on the wall. So, let's talk about jhana, right concentration. The definition of right concentration is usually explained in terms of two things. One, in terms of jhana. Two, in terms of singleness of mind. I want to go over those two terms. Jhana, as I said yesterday, is related to the verb jayati, which means to burn with a steady flame. So the word jhana means basically a steady focus that's very clear. And the implication is also just that, you know, you can read by a steady flame, whereas you can't read by, say, a fire that's burning with erratic flames. In the same way, you can read your mind a lot more clearly when it has that steadiness. The other term, ekagata, is sometimes translated as one-pointedness. The word eka means one. Aga, in that term, interpretations means point. And you get quite a lot of discussion about how it means that your awareness is reduced to one point with no awareness of the body, no awareness of your outside senses. Thing is that the word ekagata, used in everyday language in Pali, refers to a quality of mind where you're listening to somebody talking, and you're focused on what the person is saying, and you are thinking about what the person is saying in terms of appropriate attention. And so in this case, you can think at the same time you're in ekagata, and you're also able to hear sounds and be aware of your body. And I think this relates to the fact the word aga does not mean point. It has two main meanings in Pali. One is summit, the topmost point of something, or the topmost area of something. But it also means gathering place. It's a place where people come together. Like the Upasada Aga is the place where the monks come together for the Upasada. The Pataga, Pata means meal. It's the place where they come together for the meal. And I think that's what the Buddha is talking about here, because when you read the descriptions of the state of concentration that you're trying to develop, it is a whole body awareness. So it's not reduced to one point. You're fully aware of the whole body. And body here does mean body. It does mean something else. Now, we'll be going through the descriptions of the four jhanas, but I'd like to make a few comments on how, when you get the mind into jhana, you have to use some discernment to get it there. The faculty of evaluation, which is one of the factors of the first jhana, is when you're actually evaluating how well the mind and its object fit together, and where it needs to be. Things need to be adjusted so that the fit is nice and snug. So you have to use your discernment to some extent there. The property of what they call non-fashioning, and not creating a sense of self around the practice, where you don't exalt yourself or disparage others over the fact that your jhana is better than their jhana. Yeah. We had someone come to the monastery one time, and she had been to a jhana retreat, and said, I was able to get to the third jhana in the retreat, but here I'm only able to get to the second jhana. I'm going to go home. I didn't say anything. I let her go. And then one of the descriptions, which we'll be getting to, is what they call the fifth factor of jhana, which is basically, it's said to have the theme of your concentration well in hand. What basically means is you are able to analyze what's going on in the mind while you're in the state of jhana. And it's like, if you can make a comparison with the glove, and this is not in the Pali Canon, if you've got your hand fully in the glove, it's one thing. You can pull it out a little ways. You're still in the glove, but you're not quite as snugly in the glove. And in the same way, when the mind is fully in some of the higher states of jhana, you're not going to be able to think about anything. But you pull out just a little bit. John Fuang's images of pulling up a little bit above. You can look at the mind, okay, this is how my mind is relating to the object, and you begin to analyze it in terms of fabrication, analyze it in terms of the five aggregates. And then that can be your analysis for getting the mind to develop some dispassion for the aggregates, to let go of its clinging. You can also analyze jhana when you're going from one jhana to the next one. You begin to realize, okay, when I went from this state of concentration to the next one, this was dropped. You know, some states you when you leave the first jhana to go into the second jhana, you drop the evaluation and then just one with the object. When you leave the third jhana to go into fourth jhana, the breath stops, and so that's bodily fabrication falls away. And so you see different kinds of fabrication kind of peeling off as you go from one level to another. Ajahn Lee's image for that is of a person who's smelting, trying to get the different kinds of metallic ore out of a rock. You raise the heat a little bit and the tin comes out. You raise a little bit more, the lead comes out. You raise a little bit more, the zinc comes out. You raise a little bit more, the silver comes out. You raise a little bit more, the gold comes out. And so they separate themselves. You can't go in there with a little pick and separate the metals, but if you get things to the right temperature, they separate out on their own in the same way as the mana, as the mind gets into a state of jhana, moves from one to the next, certain fabrications kind of fall away. And seeing those fabrications fall away, that's as you develop discernment. Okay. The main lessons learned from jhana would be that you see the strategic need to feed the mind with non-sensual pleasure in order to go beyond sensual craving. You have to give it an alternative. You can't just say there are all these drawbacks to sensual craving, therefore I'm going to give them up. As I said the other day, it's like saying, my stomach is inconstant, food is inconstant, I'm just going to stop eating. Okay. Something in the mind is going to go off feeding someplace else, surreptitiously. So you give it something good to feed on, so that you can compare the pleasure of having the mind well concentrated and the pleasure that comes from sensuality and realize, okay, this is actually better. And this is sustaining enough so I can get rid of it, and I can let go of the other. Jhana is also a laboratory for seeing the aggregates in the process of becoming inaction. The stillness is what makes them clear, but also makes you realize that this is as good a state of fabrication can be when the mind is really still and at ease like this. And you begin to see even this, though, has its limitations. And that's when the mind is ready to let go even of that. When you see the limits of fabrication, you're willing to abandon everything for the sake of something that is unfabricated. It also means if you have experience in fabricating these states of mind, when you actually hit something unfabricated, you will recognize, okay, this is radically different. What often happens in the practice is people will hit one of these states of concentration and say, wow, this must be it. And they stop. Or it's actually still part of the path. But if you get more sensitive to the process of fabrication through creating a state of jhana like this, then you recognize the unfabricated when it happens. So let's look at some of the passages. The first two have to do with that word singleness. Visakha is talking to his former wife, Sister Damodina, and he asks her, what is concentration, what qualities are its themes, what qualities are its requisites, and what is its development? And she says, singleness of mind is concentration, the four establishings of mind bliss are its themes, the four right exertions are its requisites, and any cultivation, development, pursuit of these qualities is its development. So here, right effort, right mindfulness, and all concentration all come together. They gather around one theme. And the next passage is devoted to showing what the word egakata means in an ordinary everyday context. The Buddha is talking about how these are the five qualities you want to bring to listening to a talk. You don't hold the talk in contempt. Got that, class? You don't hold the speaker in contempt. Three, you don't hold yourself in contempt. In other words, you say, I can do this. Four, you listen to the Dharma with an unscattered mind, a mind gathered into one, ekaka chitto. And you attend appropriately. That means you listen to the talk with the questions of, okay, how can I apply this talk to my own suffering and use this to get beyond my own suffering? So you can listen when the mind is in a state of ekaka, and you can also think when it's in a state of ekaka. Passage 26 goes through the four jhanas with analogies. Okay, there's a case where quite secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful qualities, you enter and remain in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure born of seclusion accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. You permeate and pervade, suffuse and fill this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. There's nothing of your entire body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Here's the analogy. Just as if a dexterous bathman or bathman's apprentice would pour bath powder into a basin and knead it together, sprinkling it again and again with water. Back in those days, they didn't have soap. They had a kind of a soap powder that they would mix with water and make in kind of a dough. And then you would use that dough to rub over your body as you're bathing. And so in the same principle as when you're making bread, you try to mix the flour together with the water so that the water is, there's not too much water and you don't have any extra flour left over. They're mixed properly so that all the dough is well saturated. So sprinkle it again with water so that your ball of bath powder, saturated, moisture-laden, permeated within and without, would nevertheless not drip. In the same way, you permeate the views and fill this very body with a rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. There's nothing of your entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This is the first development of the five-factor noble right concentration. So as we'll notice, as we go through these various analogies, water stands for pleasure. Any movement stands for rapture. And in this first jhana, we have the only analogy that has a conscious agent doing something, and that would be the activity of directed thought and evaluation. In the second jhana, okay, with the stilling of directed thoughts and evaluations, in other words, you've evaluated the breath and the mind, so they really are snugly together. They don't really need that much more adjustment. A John Fuang's image is of putting water into a water jar. There comes a point where you put, the jar cannot take any more water. And so it's fruitless to add more water to the jar. So in the same way, when things fitting well together, you can just drop your direct thoughts and your activity of evaluation. I mean, you actually become one with the breath at this point. You enter and remain in the second jhana, rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Unification of awareness, that's what that term means, that the mind and its object are one. Unification of awareness free from directed thought and evaluation, internal assurance. And then you permeate your body with that sense of rapture and pleasure, born of concentration. Here's the analogy, just like a lake with spring water welling up from within, having no inflow from the east, west, north, or south, and with the skies periodically supplying abundant showers. So the cool fountain of water welling up from within the lake would permeate and pervade the views and fill it with cool waters, there being no part of the lake unpervaded by the cool water. That's the analogy for the second jhana. So in this case, you've got the water welling up of its own. You don't need a conscious agent to do it. There's just a sense of the rapture filling the body. And in the first jhana, you had the agent, i.e. the bathman, somewhat separate from the bath powder and the moisture, and now the moisture surrounds you entirely. In other words, the pleasure entirely surrounds you. You have the sense that you are in the midst of this, being bathed by this sense of pleasure and rapture. In the third jhana, with the fading of rapture, you remain equanimous, mindful, alert, sense pleasure of the body. You enter and remain in the third jhana, which the noble ones can declare, and equanimous and mindful, you have a pleasant abiding. And then you fill the body with a sense of pleasure. And here the image is of a lake, but there's no more movement. Just as in a blue, white, or red lotus pond, there may be some of the blue, white, or red lotuses with which, born and growing in the water, stay immersed in the water and flourish without standing up out of the water. So they're permeated and pervaded, suffused and filled with cool water from their roots to their tips. Nothing of those blue, white, or red lotuses would be unpervaded with cool water. So here you've still got the pleasure and it permeates everything, but there is no sense of rapture. And this feels, at that point, this feels more refined. Some people find rapture actually threatening and unpleasant. I have a student who had almost drowned. In fact, she just wrote an article in Tricycle about this, where she'd almost drowned one time, and as she was getting her mind into concentration, she kept saying to me, I can't do this anymore, I just feel full every time I meditate. And I said, everybody else wants to feel full. And she said she associated it with the time when she was almost drowning. There's a sense of kind of fullness that comes at that point. So I said, remind yourself you are surrounded by air all the time. There's no water around you. And that helped seem to get her past the problem. But there does come a point in the meditation where even if it's pleasant, it begins to seem kind of gross. We talked yesterday about the different frequencies of radio waves going through the air. And the second jhana begins to sound more and more like heavy metal. And the third jhana is nice, you know, it's nice. Third movement, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, really cool and soothing. So that's where you want to go. So you tune into that frequency. And then with the abandoning of pleasure and stress, as with the earlier disappearance of joy and distress, you enter and remain in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness, neither pleasure nor pain. You sit permeating the body with a white, pure, bright awareness so that there's nothing of your entire body unpervaded by pure, bright awareness. At this point, the breath is so still that it doesn't feel like it's coming in or out. This is the area where they say bodily fabrication ceases. Here the image is, the water's gone now, just as if a man was sitting wrapped from head to foot with white cloth, so there's no part of his body to which the white cloth did not extend, in the same way you sit permeating your body with a pure, bright awareness. Okay. So those are the four jhanas. Any questions on those before we move on? Which one would you like?
A question about directed thought and evaluation. Mm-hmm. Would you say that that is directing the thought to the breath coming into a point here and then evaluating the effect in the body?
Yeah.
Oh.
Or directing the, well, however you want to think about the breath, you direct your thoughts to that.
Yeah.
But as we're going through section by section, you, okay, you direct your thoughts to that section. If we're trying to develop a full body awareness, direct your thoughts to thinking full body, full body, full body. And then evaluating, okay, how does it feel? Are you able to maintain it? Because yeah. Basically what I've been doing with a guided meditation is basically trying to get you into the first jhana. Oh. And this is how it's done. Yes.
So the seclusion part, secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful qualities, is the directed thought and evaluation play a role in that seclusion, or is it?
Well, it's and to begin with, it will. But when you finally say, okay, you're putting those things aside, and now you can direct your thoughts to the breath and not be distracted by those other things. Now, sometimes you see this as secluded from sensual pleasures. It sounds like you have to go to a really nasty place, which is not the case at all. You're secluded from your fascination with thinking about sensual pleasures. And the seclusion also means that they haven't been uprooted yet, but you're just away from them for the time being.
But I guess there's also some kind of feedback loop, because as you're experiencing more of the pleasure of the first jhana, then it tends to fall away anyway, I would assume.
Yeah, I mean, as the pleasure gets more intense, you get more and more interested in the pleasure. And here the trick is, how do you stay with the pleasure but not drop the breath? Because if you drop the breath, then you tend to zone out, which you don't want.
Okay, thanks.
Yes. So what do you do when the breath disappears by itself?
Okay, then you just stay with your full body, sense of the whole body.
What if you panic a little bit?
Don't. If you panic, you'll start breathing again. Yeah. And, I mean, if you can stay with the sense that the breath is really, really still and not panic, then you can actually get into the deeper states of concentration. So you have to remind yourself, when we talk about breath, we're talking about the energy that's already there. So there's no felt need to pull anything in from outside. And the other objection that sometimes comes up is, what about the oxygen you need in your body? And there are differing theories about this, but one is that you're actually getting some oxygen in through your skin. You have the little blood vessel, the capillaries come out to the skin, and they can actually pick up some oxygen, which if you're not thinking very much, if your mind is very, very still, your brain is the major user of oxygen in the body. So when that's more still, the level of oxygen you're getting in from the skin should be enough. There's a town down in Southern California, Laguna Beach, where I teach sometimes. And they have something called the Festival of the Arts and the Pageant of the Masters. And what they do is they try to recreate famous paintings or famous statues on a revolving stage. And when they started out, they were, you know, for David and Venus and whatnot, they would go down to the beach and find people with nice bodies and say, come up, we're going to paint you white and make you as a statue. Why does that amuse you? It's very Southern California, isn't it? Yes. And so they had the problem. They painted them all white. And then as the revolving stage came around, David just fainted. And they realized it because they clogged up all the pores of his skin with the paint. And so they had to, from in the future when they do this, now they leave the back part exposed, you know, unpainted. So there's actually some oxygen exchange that goes on there. So you can remind yourself, okay, if I really need to breathe, I will. It's just that the body doesn't feel any need. More questions?
So I always just thought it was me thinking I had stopped breathing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's actually that.
It can actually happen. It can actually happen, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. There are times, though, when it stops for a little bit and you're not really solidly enough there, and then the body will feel the need to breathe again, so you start breathing. So, but it doesn't stop because you've suppressed it. It's just that you feel that the breath energy in the body is enough. And this is, gets... This perception I told about just now, the sense that there is already breath in the body, and you're going to allow that to fill the body. They're kind of, when John Lee talks about what he calls the resting places of the breath, one is right above the navel, another is right at the tip of the sternum. There are others at the base of the throat, middle of the head, top of the head. And different people feel that they can actually sense the breath energy being full in one of those spots there, and then just think of it spreading to fill the body. And the need to, the felt need to breathe gets less and less and less. They've done experiments to show that they cannot account for the amount of energy that you expend in the course of the day based on the amount of food you eat and the amount of breath you take in. So it's more than just what you're getting in from outside. There's a kind of energy generator inside.
The unification of awareness, the awareness that's referred to, is that the same as the consciousness of the five aggregates?
No, that's closer to citta. It's basically unification of mind. They have two words, cetas and citta in Pali, and they're very close. And I tend to translate cetas as awareness and citta as mind. But basically your whole sense of awareness is unified there. And then the question is, what's the relationship of citta to consciousness? And the texts don't really explain.
Ajahn, isn't citta heart and mind together?
It can be heart, it can be mind. And cetas can also be heart or mind. It's like that. Here we are, we're training the mind to put an end to suffering and we find true happiness. Three words that are never defined in the canon are mind, suffering, happiness. What's defined is the training. And your sense of your mind and a sense of suffering and a sense of happiness are going to develop as you train the mind. So I think the Buddha intentionally leaves those undefined because your sense of what they are is going to change as you move through the practice.
Ajahn, you've been talking about the breath kind of reducing and getting more subtle and maybe stopping.
Mm-hmm.
And if one is, if breath is one's object of meditation, then what becomes the object?
Well, basically a body. And then as Ajahn Lee would say, you've got those breath energies in the body which are not related to the in and out breath that are already present. And that becomes the object. But this is one of the reasons why it's good to try to develop a full body awareness. As the breath gets more and more, as the in and out breath gets more and more subtle, because it is possible when the breath gets really, really subtle and you're focused on one point, you lose it. And you've probably had that experience. It's like falling into an air pocket. You just kind of, you know, startled a little bit. Well, you lost the topic of it. You lost the object of your awareness, of your mindfulness, of your concentration for a moment. So as soon as things start getting comfortable, think whole body. Or start a survey building up to a whole body. And that keeps the mind busy enough to keep it alert.
Two questions that often come up for people who are wanting to know more about jhana is around the amount of time
mm-hmm.
that one might be in these states that you can say, oh, this is a state of jhana versus a temporary kind of touching into something. So it's
mm-hmm.
one part, and then the second is around, you know, someone might say, oh, I can go into like four stage jhana, but not first stage. So my understanding is that it is sequential.
The answer to the first question is that you want to be there pretty long, because the whole purpose of this is to get familiar. We're not chalking up points. Hey, first jhana. It's okay, you did it, but what did you learn from it? Nothing, you know. You want to stay there long enough, you can see, oh, this is what the mind is like when it's dropped sensuality, and this is the sense of pleasure that comes from it. And then if I stop the directed thought and evaluation, I can just stay with the breath. What have I learned about the mind there? Because as we get to the next passage, we're going to see you have to be able to do this really well before you can even start analyzing it. If you analyze it too quickly, you destroy it. And then as for the second question,
jumping.
I would say you have to at least have at some point in the past gone through the first jhana. Because you need that sense of pleasure. I mean, if you're going to go straight to equanimity, it's not going to be that solid. It's going to be what they call willed equanimity, equanimity based on multiplicity, which is not as the solidity that you would have with the equanimity. It's when the mind is really there because it's had its dose of pleasure and it's already had its dose of rapture and now it's ready to settle down. This is a theme you get throughout, is that when you're going to calm things down, first you have to energize them. And then, okay, whatever lack of energy they have, that's been satisfied, and now that kind of calms down naturally, without you just forcing it down. Any other questions? Mike?
John, the moments of greatest stillness and concentration I seem to have had have been very brief, mm-hmm. and the mental experience that seems to have made me pull away from them, it doesn't feel like kind of grasping onto them, mm-hmm. Or being afraid of them, but it's a sense that it's not a sense of fatigue, but it's a sense that this momentary experience, if sustained, mm-hmm. would be exhausting. And mm-hmm. so it's like I, without even trying to see if that's the case or not, my mind kind of shies away from the sensation of impending exhaustion. Can you offer any
okay,
advice?
In that case, just think, okay, what kind of breathing would feel energizing right now, say, not exhausting, exhausted. Rather than pulling away, say, okay, what can I pull into this state so that would actually energize it? And test it sometimes to see if it really is exhausting, you know. Instead of saying, oh, I don't know, I don't know.
I guess part of the problem is it can't be conjured up quickly, so I have to wait for the next
time. You have to wait
now.
For the next time, yes.
I'll
they
tell
go
you.
There right now, and then we'll talk about it.
Thank you.
Because one of the qualities of a state that really is jhana is that it's very self-sustaining. But part of that is there's a sense of mastery that you know how to sort of bring things together in the right proportions. So you're not pushing down too hard. But there's a sense that things just kind of have been energized and now they're settling down. And they feel okay. And they've got the energy they need. That's the quality that you're looking for. So if you are feeling, okay, this could be exhausting, I've got to figure out, okay, where's the lack of energy? What energy do I have that I can add to this right now? That'll sustain it without my feeling worn out by this.
And then presumably that's something I need to be doing every day in my meditation.
You should try to begin to do that. You try to keep at this every day. And when you do have these moments of stillness and it comes out and it felt good. If it didn't feel good, there's something wrong. If it felt good, then you say, where was I? Where was I focused? What was the breath like? Can I recreate that the next time? To get a sense that I know where to tune in. The potential is right there, and all I have to do is tune in right there. Instead of thinking, oh, I've got to build it up from the ground floor again. These are potentials that are already there in the body and the mind. You just got to have to locate them and learn how to stay with them. I was talking with a famous jhana teacher one time, and he does 7-minute jhanas. you know, 7 minute first jhana, 7 minute second jhana. And someone once asked him, why do you skip after 7 minutes? It's because it feels, it starts getting painful after 7 minutes. He said, that's not jhana, I'm sorry. Because it's, you know, when you really hit it, you say, I could really stay here for a long period of time and feel satisfied. That's the kind of quality of concentration you want. Passage 27 talks about how you use jhana as a basis for gaining discernment and awakening. This is the one where you are actually analyzing it while you're in the state. Suppose that an archer or archer's apprentice were to practice on a straw man or a mound of clay, so that after a while he would become able to shoot long distances, to fire accurate shots in rapid succession, and to pierce great masses. Okay, there's another passage where this is actually a symbol of, you know, full mastery of your jhana. To fire accurate shots in rapid succession means that you can get into jhana quickly. To shoot long distances means you can stay there long periods of time. To pierce great masses is you learn how to understand what's going on. In the same way, there's a case where a monk enters and remains in the first jhana. Rapture and pleasure born of seclusion accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. Okay, this following analysis then will apply to all the four jhanas. You regard whatever phenomena there that are connected with form, feeling, perception, fabrications, and consciousness as inconstant, stressful, a disease, a cancer, an arrow, painful, an affliction, alien, a disintegration, and emptiness, not self. Okay, those are the perceptions that give rise to a sense of dispassion. As for what is form, feeling, perception, fabrications, and consciousness in the jhana, form would be your sense of the body. Feeling here would be the sense of pleasure or rapture, or equanimity in the fourth jhana. Perception would be the perceptions that are holding you with the breath, the image of breath that you're holding in mind, the image of body that you're holding in mind. Fabrications would be, say, directed thought and evaluation, or any intentions you have to maintain that state of jhana. And then consciousness would be awareness of all those things. So here's a case where you're using the aggregates to make a path. And once you've made the path, then you analyze them and say, oh, these two are inconstant, stressful, and not self. Those are the perceptions that give rise to dispassion. And through that dispassion, you look at these things. Inconstant, okay, that's inconstant. Stressful, stressful. A disease is another term for stress. Cancer, an arrow, painful, and affliction. Those are all stressful. Alien, not self. Disintegration, inconstant, emptiness, not self, and then not self. So these are elaborations on those three perceptions. So once you develop a sense of dispassion, you turn your mind away from those phenomena, and having done so, you incline the mind to the property of deathlessness. This is peace, this is exquisite, the resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, unbinding. In other words, you incline the mind to something that is unfabricated, having seen that even the nice fabrications of right concentration are still kind of gross. Staying right there, you either reach the ending of the effluence, or if not, then through a passion or delight in that dharma, the dharma of deathlessness. And passion and delight are another term for clinging. You're clinging to that concept, or you're clinging to that experience of the deathless. That's what keeps you from gaining total awakening. But it's not so bad, you get on return. From the total ending of the five lower fetters, self-identity views, uncertainty, grasping at habits and practices, sensual passion and irritation, you're due to arise spontaneously in the pure abodes, there to be totally unbound, never again to return from that world. So in other words, you get the mind into jhana, and then you pull out a little bit and you analyze in terms of the five aggregates. And then you develop the perceptions that lead to dispassion for those aggregates. In other words, you see this too, even though this is really pleasurable, this is really intense, it has its ups and downs, it has its fabricated problems. The question is, wouldn't it be better to have something totally unfabricated? And because the mind has reached the point where this is the best fabrications can be, the only alternative is either to return to lower fabrications or to go to something unfabricated. This is one of the ways in which awakening is based on the four jhanas. Passage 28 talks about using, gaining insight as you go from one jhana to the next. Okay. When you've attained the first jhana, speech has ceased. When you've attained the second jhana, directed thoughts and evaluations, which are verbal fabrications, have ceased. When you've attained the third jhana, rapture has ceased. When you've attained the fourth jhana, in and out breathing, bodily fabrication has ceased. Then based on the fourth jhana, you can go into these formless states, which we don't need to go into right now. But you see as you move from one level of concentration that a certain layer or type of fabrication has fallen away. And that insight can sometimes be enough to say, okay, I want to let go of all fabrication. Rather than moving into the next jhana, I want to just get out of this process entirely. So there's a two ways that jhana can be used as a basis for insight. Because what's happening is as you see, as you get first-hand experience with creating the sense of jhana, then you begin to see, okay, this is exactly what the Buddha is talking about when he says perception or direct a thought and evaluation, because you actually see them falling away.
John?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned form is the body, feeling, is that piti and sukha? And then fabrications is directed in evaluation?
Or intention.
Or intention. Mm-hmm. And what was perception?
Just however you, whatever perception you hold in mind that's keeping you with the object.
Okay.
Because the Buddha says that every attainment up through the dimension of nothingness is a perception attainment. You have to hold a certain metal label in mind to keep yourself with the object. Otherwise, you lose it.
Right.
Any other questions?
When one does get to a place where they're in the glove, do you have to pull back and evaluate? What if it's very peaceful, comfortable, calm, quiet, and you don't want to go anywhere?
Okay, you can stay there.
Okay.
And the Buddha says there are four uses for concentration. One is to have that sense of a pleasant abiding. If you come home from a hard day of magic, and you need a place to rest, I'm just going to hang out here for a while because I need to rest. But there comes a point where, you've slept enough. You've had enough rest. And then it's time to move on and say, okay, what other uses can I get out of it? Because, it can also improve your mindfulness and alertness because you're quicker to see things. And then also can provide a basis for gaining discernment. It can also provide the basis for psychic powers, but I don't think you're ready for that yet. Even though I could tell you all kinds of cool stories, but I won't. Yes, Plex.
About the five aggregates, mm-hmm. Is consciousness the glue that binds them all?
It's simply what is the receptive part of the mind that knows these things.
It knows.
Yeah, it just registers the contact. Okay. The perception is what identifies what it is that's been registered.
Okay. And what if I turn my attention to that knowing, to that consciousness itself?
Mm-hmm.
What result can I...
You could ultimately get the mind into the state that's called the infinitude of consciousness. It's just consciousness aware of consciousness.
Okay.
That's how far you can get with that analysis.
Okay. And would it be like a dead end, or?
You could use it as a basis for analysis. That's even the state of consciousness focused on consciousness is fabricated. As with any state of concentration, you either just chill out there and turn it into a dead end, or you can say, okay, I need to understand, is there still something inconstant here? Is there still ups and downs in the level of stress? If so, that shows that there's some fabrication going on. I've got to get something deeper, more solid.
Very well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've been talking about the factors of the path. And to conclude about the relationship among the factors, right concentration contains right mindfulness, which contains right effort. And all the other factors are needed for concentration to be honest and focused on the right goal. I mean, your ability to observe the precepts and stick with them gives a quality of honesty to your concentration. If you're sort of dishonest in the way you live your life, your concentration is going to be dishonest, and it's going to lead to trouble. And it's the discernment and in terms of right view and right resolve that keep things focused on the right goal. And the goal itself is awakening or unbinding. Okay. Strictly speaking, unbinding is described as existing. There is such a thing. And even though it cannot be properly defined, the Buddha does talk about it in terms of five ways to indicate that it's pretty cool. It's a worthwhile goal. Okay. I just want to go down the five ways in which he talks about it. One, he calls it a consciousness without surface. That was what's referred to in passage 29, where he says, having directly known the all as all. Here the word all refers to all the six senses. Having directly known the extent of what has not been experienced through the allness of the all, I wasn't the all, I wasn't in the all, I wasn't coming from the all, I wasn't saying all is mine. I didn't affirm the all. In other words, there's something more beyond the six senses. And then he has this verse, consciousness without surface, endless, radiant all around, has not been experienced through the earthness of earth, the liquidity of liquid, the fireness of fire, the windiness of wind, or the allness of the all. In other words, this is something outside the six senses, but it's still a consciousness that's independent of the six senses. So, in other words, you're not blanking out. There's a kind of consciousness. The image they use in the canon is of a light beam that doesn't land anywhere. The image they have is of a house that has a window on the east side and a wall on the west side. And the question is, when the sun rises, where does the beam of light going through the window, where does it land? It lands on the west wall. What if there's no west wall? Well, it lands on the ground. What if there's no ground? It lands on the water. What if there's no water? It doesn't land. And that's the image of a consciousness that doesn't have any surface, doesn't have any place where it lands. So this would not be consciousness of consciousness. It's something totally beyond that. It's also described as an unestablished consciousness or an unrestricted awareness. So it's total knowing, but without any object. It is also described as a truth in the sense that it's unfabricated, unchanging, undeceptive, unwavering, permanence, ageless, undecaying, deathless, and true. Okay. The third quality is that it's bliss. Some of the terms the Buddha uses is the exquisite, the unafflicted, hunger-free, unaffected by death, peace, rest, security, island, shelter, harbor, and refuge. The fourth quality is freedom. Release from all defilements, release from the aggregates. Unbinding, we've already described that as being freed by letting go. Effluent free, attachment free, free from longing, non-objectification. Objectification is the kind of thinking that starts out where you make an assumption about who I am, and then the other issues that come from taking on the identity of being a being. You've turned yourself into someone who needs to feed. And of course, a feeder needs a world to feed on. And as the Buddha says, once you start taking on that kind of identity, you're going to be coming in conflict with others because they also want to feed off the same world that you want to feed off of. And there's nothing of that. So it's freedom from that. The ending of craving, dispassion, and purity. And finally, excellence. And here the Buddha simply uses terms like the amazing, the astounding, the ultimate, and beyond. So it's the best thing there is. So it is a kind of consciousness, but it's not fabricated. It's true, blissful, free, and excellent. Those are the qualities of the goal that we're aiming at. So, questions? Who's quitting in the first bid?
Uh-huh.
in passage 25, one does not hold the talk in contempt, one does not hold the speaker in contempt, and one doesn't hold oneself in contempt. Can you give an example of each of them?
Okay, this is a lousy talk.
Okay.
That's the first one. The speaker is an idiot. Second one. Three. I don't think I could ever do this.
Oh. Okay, that's a very good idea. Very good answer, yes. I like it. It's a very simple one. In 29, consciousness without surface is... would this be like a basis for psychic powers?
No. No. It's totally unrelated to anything.
Okay.
The basis for psychic powers would be any one of the jhanas, usually the fourth. And it's not, psychic attainments do not assume a noble attainment. Consciousness of that surface is attained only by noble ones. Whereas the psychic powers can be based on the fourth jhana. I mean, there's the case of Devadatta had psychic powers, but then because of his greed, aversion, and delusion, he got led astray. So you can't trust everybody who has psychic powers.
Thank you.
You have a question over here.
So the so for the unbinding, so if there's nothing conditioned, so there shouldn't be any sense of anything moving or changing, right?
Mm-hmm.
There should be no sense of time.
It's outside of space and time.
Right. And there should be no perception of any movement, right?
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. John, could you just go over the list again of the
five?
Final? Yes.
Okay, it is a state of consciousness, but conscious without surface. It's not part of the consciousness aggregate. Because conscious aggregate has to be in space and time, and this is outside. The second quality is that it is true, i.e. it doesn't change. Third quality is bliss, really happy. And the question arises in the canon, so wait a minute, if there's no aggregate of feeling, how can you say that it's bliss? And the Buddha says, there's bliss that's not in the aggregates. No, it's not Bitti or Sukha. It's a different, it's qualitatively very different from that. The fourth quality is freedom. You're free from defilement, free from conflict. And the fifth quality is excellence. In other words, it's just beyond anything you can imagine. And so that's what this is all for. Any questions to tie things up?
My question is, does that experience, I don't know, maybe nobody knows, does it come and go? Does it come and go? Once you have... The Buddha reached that state, mm-hmm. presumably when he was under the tree. But then did he revert back to a more worldly state?
For there are degrees of awakening. This was called stream entry, and then once return, non-return, and arahantship. With the first three, it's you might say a chunk of time. I mean, there would be a period when you are experiencing that. And then you come out. And the reason you come out was because you started clinging to it, and in clinging to it, you separate yourself from it. But with the arahantship, they don't cling, and therefore they're not separated from it. So it's like they can contact that whenever they want. It's kind of like sit there in the background.
Uh, I got two. One's a probably a fast one. In the last paragraph, 30, it says, practice jhana monks.
Mm-hmm.
So in Pali, I'm guessing the Pali is
Jayata. Yeah, Jayata.
Okay. It's not bhavana, so it's...
It's not bhavana, it's Jayata. Yeah. Okay. Dogu jhana.
Okay. Okay, that's good. And then the other one is just like, it's a lot like June's question, like, you know, accidentally going out of order in the jhana practice, you know, mm-hmm. And just popping into some weird state.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a question, is it?
Well, it's
it happens.
You can pop into a weird state, but the question is it stable enough?
No.
No, and it's what you're trying to do is build up to these stages in a way that you can, once you attain that again, it will be stable. You can stay there. Because even some of the more refined ones, like a state of nothingness or a state of consciousness, we've had tastes of that in the course of our lives. But because we didn't have the proper amount of mindfulness and powers of concentration, we weren't able to stay there. And the whole purpose of this is learning how to get the mind trained so that it's ready to stay. Mm-hmm. So if you think, okay, I popped into that, but then you popped out, okay, I got to go back and sort of work my way up the stairs. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's like jumping up,
getting back down again. It's a fluke.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any last questions on anything? You have a question on anything?
Well, I don't know if you want to go here, but on Friday at the having tea, you described describing some teachings of the Buddha through an analogy of making ratatouille, and didn't know if it'd be appropriate to share that with this group. Yeah.
This is my ratatouille recipe. Okay. The issue came up in France, you know, where they were for the word mindfulness, they use plein conscience, which literally means full awareness. And there was this one woman in particular who was having a problem with the idea of mindfulness being a faculty of the memory. And she kept trying to push it back to some kind of full awareness. And so I finally said, and then finally the last question she asked after a couple of days was, does this mean there are several kinds of conscience, several kinds of awareness? And I said, okay, yes, we need a vocabulary lesson here. And I said, pretend you're making ratatouille. Now you've got the ingredients lined up on the shelf, and your ability to recognize the ingredients. So this is eggplant, this is zucchini, this is tomato, this is garlic. That's perception. Mindfulness is remembering the recipe. And then you also remember there are certain added things that when you are making the ratatouille, you have to watch out for. You know, so that the tomatoes don't get undercooked, or this doesn't get overcooked, or whatever. That's appropriate attention. Your awareness of this while you're doing it, that's consciousness. And then if you find out, okay, the ingredients are not up to snuff, how do I make adjustments? You know, the tomatoes are kind of tasteless, what other things do I have to adjust to make it the ratatouille, a good ratatouille? That would be discernment. Also potentially, and you've heard that some people put olives in their ratatouille, and when I said that, a shiver went through the room. And so your discernment is basically, is this a good time to put olives in the ratatouille or not?
California.
Well, actually, no, it's Provençal. The first time we had olives in ratatouille was in Provence. So it's not a California abomination. Although it turned out we had a cook in the audience, and he was from Nice. And in Nice, they don't even put tomatoes in ratatouille. And they're very proud of that fact. As far as I'm concerned, I wouldn't want to eat it. but that's you know, neither here nor there. But that analogy seemed to sort of clear things out. Okay, mindfulness is remembering the recipe. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Joseph?
When the Buddha experienced unbinding, mm-hmm. it's told that there were three sets of knowledge, and there were the first two of the unfolding of his own karma over lifetimes, and then is that something that can happen to an individual other than the Buddha?
There are people who've been known to know those things. John Lee apparently had everything except he could not levitate. But all the psychic powers that are described in the texts he had, plus a few that were not described in the texts. You want to hear about him?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, we're ending on nirvana. It's kind of getting kind of abstract, and everybody's getting kind of this glazed look on their eyes. One was that even though he couldn't levitate himself, he could get other people to levitate. And there are two stories about this. And John Fuang was involved in both. One was there on a tudong one time in Ayutthaya. And there's the site of the old palace there, which is now covered with this kind of tree called putsa. It's quite a large tree with big spreading branches. And so one evening they were out meditating under the putsa tree, and they had hung a rope from one of the branches down. And there was this young kid who was about 12, 13 years old who had come along with the monks to help fix rice and that kind of stuff. And so John Lee gets all the monks to sit in a circle around him, and he says, okay, we're going to get you to levitate. And then John Fung thought to himself, what do you mean, we are going to get you to levitate? You're going to get him to levitate, but he didn't say anything. And then John Lee says, if you find yourself coming off the ground and you get scared, hold on to the rope so you don't fall. So sure enough, they're sitting there and comes up about this far off the ground before he realizes what's happened. And he notices it, and he's so startled he doesn't even think about the rope. He just falls down and hurts his rear and can't sit for several days afterwards. The other story with levitation, another time, monks sitting in a circle, and John Lee was here, and John Fuang was kind of over here. And John Fuang began to notice that the monk next to John Lee suddenly... And then the next monk. Up, down. And John Fuang says to himself, he's not going to do it to me. And so it starts going around the circle one by one by one. And John Fuang said he had this image of his rear end being rooted way deep down in the ground. And he just held on to that image. And just thinking, earth, 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 heavy, 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 heavy. And so the next monk rises up, falls down. Then he feels this force coming up beneath him. And it stops. And then the next monk rises up. And then when the whole thing was over and they were leaving meditation, and John Lee turned to him and said, stubborn. And the other one, which I think is one of the, if you're going to have psychic powers, this is pretty cool. There are a group of old army officers who like to come and see John Lee when he was in Bangkok. And they like to hear stories about his adventures out in the forest. And they say, you know, we'd really like to go out in the forest with you sometime. He says, come on, you guys, you're getting old, you're getting pot-bellied, you're not the soldiers you used to be. He says, oh no, we're really soldiers at heart, we're ready for the hardships of the forest life. So he says, okay, I'm going to go into the forest at a certain time, and then you can come in and be with me the first night. And then you can walk out, and I'll go further into the forest afterwards. So everything gets arranged, they get to this one spot, get off the train, start going into the forest. And sure enough, the day is hot and it's buggy and they're getting tired and thirsty and hungry, and they start complaining. They'd like to stop and rest, but John Lee doesn't listen. He just keeps going, 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 going. Finally gets to this area where there's this ridge up ahead of them. And he says, okay, up in the top of the ridge there is a banana grove. And when we get up there, you guys can stop and have some bananas. So they get up there, they find the banana grove. They have some bananas, and they're being kind of sloppy. They're leaving the banana peels scattered around. He says, look, you can't live in the forest and be sloppy like this. You've got to be neat. And so he says, take all those banana peels, put them in a little pile, and then put your machete in that pile of banana peels. And then tomorrow when you come back out, stop off, get the machete, go back out. So they agree. And so they go in, spend the night, have the meal the next morning. And John Lee goes further into the forest. They come back out. They get to the ridge. There is no banana grove. And they look around and they find that life in a pile of excrement. And As I said, if you had psychic powers, that'd be the psychic power you want to have. And so when John Lee gets back to the monastery, they all come and they bow, and I say, we're really sorry that we caused you all that trouble. But I knew some lay people who could remember their previous lives. Students of a John Fung or students of a John Lee. So that these powers are still available to people. For some reason, there seem to be more of them over there than there are over here. But I think that's partly related to the fact of, you know, mass education tends to wipe out that potential in people. Fortunately, that kind of stuff is not needed for awakening. But it makes for great stories. Anything else? Yes?
Why do you say that mass education wipes out that potential?
Well, why does mass education wipe it out? I really can't tell you, but most of the people I knew who had that kind of power had only had a fourth grade education. I knew a few people who had actually gone to university who had those powers too, but they were very rare. There's something about the qualities of mind that are developed in through a mass education that are antithetical to the kind of sensitivity that's required for this. I was talking this morning about that old woman who was a student of John Fung, and she had about a fourth grade education, and she started developing powers like this, more kind of knowing what was going on. And two of her stories were great. The things that she learned through her meditation, once she had the ability to check on what people were doing, and so she said, well, let's check on my daughter. And she wasn't that wealthy. She had managed to scrape together enough money to send her daughter to America for school. And so she went to check up on her daughter. So it was the middle of the day, and so she checked up and saw the daughter sleeping. And so in the vision, she yells at her and says, why are you sleeping? It's daytime. You should be studying. And the vision, she said, Mom, it's nighttime over here. You know, how can that be? Daytime is daytime, and nighttime is nighttime. Then she found out later that it was true. The other time, she was sitting in a hut, and the radio came on and said there was a typhoon coming in from the Gulf of Siam, and it was going to come right to where she was. And she was in a mangrove swamp, and the mangroves have this tree that the Thai call Samar, which is quite a large tree. And it's got a very shallow root system. It has a lot of little aerial roots that come up through the mud and into the seawater, but its roots don't go down very deep. And when storms come through, those are usually the first to get knocked over. And so she was kind of concerned because there was a big Samar tree right over her hut. She thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to get squashed like a bug. Well, let's see what happens with these storms. Anyhow, why is there storms? And so she got into meditation, and she saw this column of air rising and the other air turning around. I mean, basically, you know, seventh grade science, but she had never learned this in school. And she said, what happens if you cut the column of air? And so she went, cut, 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 cut. And about 15 minutes later, the news came on. The storm has disappeared. So she said, I don't know if I did it, but... No. Okay, enough entertainment. Anywhere serious questions before I go? Okay, well, thank you for your attention. I hope this has been useful.